You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
I personally have my doubts that we're ever actually going to end up leaving Europe, because I think the complications in Northern Ireland are just a small part of the really serious complications we're going to face with Brexit in general.
Jonathan Powell, former chief British negotiator on Northern Ireland, on an aspect of Brexit that probably should have been discussed before the vote. What does it mean for Northern Ireland? My guests Tom Edwards, Steve Bloomfield, Marcus Hippie and Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Helsinki's offer to host the meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. It can't be the weather, so why are Scandinavian capitals such good locations for summits, and the descent of the Speaker of Brazil's Congress from power broker to prisoner, and... the increasing trend to combine telenovelas and musicals. What could go wrong? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Monocle's Steve Bloomfield, Tom Edwards, Marcus Hippie and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, a veritable cavalcade of talents. Welcome all to the programme. This week saw the United Kingdom pull the trigger on Article 50, launching a two-year process of hopping up and down, clutching one foot and wondering why it did that. Among the many, many aspects of Brexit that nobody really thought through is Northern Ireland, a subject barely discussed during the referendum campaign, but likely to become obvious. Obstinately, perhaps dangerously unavoidable during the upcoming negotiations. On tomorrow's edition of The Foreign Desk, Monocle's Steve Bloomfield will be looking at this issue in depth. Let's hear a brief clip from that programme about the current status of the border. This is, again, Jonathan Powell, former chief British government negotiator on Northern Ireland.
You can drive in Northern Ireland now and you won't even know where the border is. People crisscross the border all of the time. If that border is reimposed, as it will have to be if we have a different customs policy in the north than in the Republic of Ireland, and if it's imposed because we have a different immigration policy in the north than in the south, that will undermine the basis of the Good Friday Agreement.
Jonathan Powell there. Steve, obviously the Foreign Desk tomorrow deals with this in more detail, but at the risk of giving away the ending, how concerned is Jonathan Powell about Northern Ireland in the next couple of years?
He's very much concerned, as was our other guest, Dennis Murray, who for about 20 years was the BBC's Ireland correspondent. And as you say, this is one of those issues that really should have been discussed more during the referendum campaign.
I don't recall it coming up once.
If you look back, it did come up a bit. It did come up a bit. However, it was overshadowed by what was known as blue on blue, which was fights within the Conservative Party. So John Major and Tony Blair, two former prime ministers, tried to make a big thing about what was going to happen in Northern Ireland. They did say, look, this will imperil the peace process. But we end up talking about £350 million being spent on the EU every week. And why don't we spend that on the NHS instead? Why does it matter? What will it mean? At the moment, as Jonathan was saying there, you can cross that border very, very easily. This was a key part of the Good Friday Agreement. Remember, this was an issue about whether Northern Ireland would be able to remain as part of the United Kingdom or whether it should become part of a United Ireland. And the way to square that circle was to essentially say, you can pretty much be both. Northern Ireland would stay as part of the United Kingdom, but there would be frictionless travel between the two. You could cross the border whenever you wanted. Trade could happen between the border. People could do what they pleased. The moment that you have a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, that whole agreement can fall apart. And you have to have a hard border. If Northern Ireland is not in the European Union and the Republic of Ireland is in the European Union, you have to have a border. There's just no getting away from that.
And that, of course, does have, well, I mean, it's obviously a massive inconvenience for thousands of people who live in the vicinity. People literally commute across that border every day. They walk their dogs and ride their horses across that border. But there's also, Tom Edwards, the psychological effect of that, isn't there? Because as Steve points out, lots of negotiation went into the current status that we currently have. Everybody did agree that basically Northern Ireland is a bit in and a bit out. But that would seem to a lot of people to be a reimposition of the barrier, wouldn't it?
Well, indeed, and it runs a lot deeper than a psychological barrier. And it was interesting that Donald Tusk specifically cited in his remarks earlier today the example of Northern Ireland as being one of these places where the EU needs to put citizens first, whether that's EU citizens or potentially without the EU, UK citizens. If you have a hard border, you need personnel there. You need checkpoints, custom stops, whatever you want to call it.
Which means you have targets.
And if you think
there.
Back, you have targets. And then that would mean that you had police there, and then that would mean that you had the military there, and so on up the chain of command. You can see why someone like Jonathan Powell, who, you know, was right at the heart of a discussion about why dissolving that hard border was so critical to peace, you can see why people are so worried. One thing I think that is interesting is, what's the view of this from within the European Union more broadly? I find it almost impossible to foresee any situation where, you know, whoever the negotiating teams are, whatever representatives from the 27 are, that they essentially instigate a border setup that increases the likelihood of violence, terrorism, whatever you want to call it. How could they possibly sign that off? And one does wonder whether this could be something more than, Steve, a fly in the ointment. It could be a fundamental block to Brexit even going forward much further.
I don't think it will be. I think Brexit will still happen. And strangely, the one thing that makes me think, well, this might not be the absolute disaster everyone thinks it is that everyone is now finally talking about it. And you then start thinking, well, look, is there a way you could fudge this whereby actually it wasn't really a hard border at all? Because really, what are the chances of, for example, the archetypal Polish plumber flying to Dublin, still in the European Union, driving up to Northern Ireland, then hopping on a ferry across to England, or even getting on a plane from Belfast to London, then working in London? It's a bit of a weird workaround. I don't think many people are actually going to do that. I don't think it's going to have a big impact on the immigration numbers. But then it's also about security, and it's about trade and customs. And that is then when it becomes an issue, because if you have tariffs between the European Union and Britain, if there are rules on how trade is governed, whereby it is cheaper for someone within the European Union to trade with a fellow European Union member than it is with Britain, then you have to have that border. And the more you think about it, the more impossible it is to see a way around it.
Maybe I have an outsider's point of view over here, but I find it quite surprising, considering the seriousness of the situation, how little Prime Minister Theresa May has been paying attention to this issue. I feel like she's been very busy writing a letter to Brussels to impose the Article 50. She's been telling the nations to stay together without actually offering any carrots. I feel like there's only stick coming from her direction, but I think we should hear something from her. I think she should recognize the seriousness of the situation. I'm thinking of people in Northern Ireland. I think just the lack of seeming interest from Theresa May's part can increase frustration over there.
That's one of the interesting things that we discussed on the Foreign Desk, was that, as Jonathan Powell said, they wanted to make, during the negotiations to end the war, their goal was to make Northern Ireland boring. Because this was a story that dominated the news in the UK for 30 years. 3,500 people were killed. The province was split in two, essentially. And they wanted to make it boring. They've succeeded. It's boring. You now get, for example, the current political stalemate in Northern Ireland is over a botched green energy deal. Now, you know, you can't get more boring than that compared to what happened before. But the problem is, it's become so boring that, and you have a new generation of leaders, that as Marcus quite rightly points out, the Prime Minister right now doesn't seem engaged with it in the level that Tony Blair before her was, Gordon Brown before her was. Even actually, let's go back, John Major was engaged in this as well. You know, we're hearing from James Brokenshire, the Northern Ireland Secretary, who most people in Britain can't name, let alone spot in a lineup. Theresa May hasn't been over to Belfast to try and sort out the current problem that's happening right now. That's going to be a big issue.
Well, in fairness to Blair, Brown and Major, none of them had a sort of multifaceted, umpty-dimensional, self-inflicted shambles they had to deal with on top of Northern Ireland. A reminder that tomorrow's edition of The Foreign Desk does look in detail at that question. Northern Ireland and Brexit, with contributions from Jonathan Powell, the former chief negotiator on Northern Ireland, and BBC's former Ireland correspondent, Dennis Murray. That's at midday London time, any time you like after that on our website.
This has essentially been an advert for my programme, hasn't it?
It has.
Okay.
It has.
I'm going to leave now and someone else can come in, okay?
Thank you, Steve. We will move along now to the most keenly anticipated caption competition in recent history, i.e. the proposed meeting in May of Presidents Donald Trump of the United States and Vladimir Putin of Russia. This meeting may occur in Helsinki as it hosts a summit of the Arctic Council. Finland's President Sauli Niinisto said that his country would be honoured to host the long-awaited meeting between the demagogues seeking to lay waste to the diplomatic and economic framework of the Western world and Vladimir Putin. I should also update you on our personnel. Monocle Steve Bloomfield has now seamlessly transformed into Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, which would have given me a hell of a fright if I wasn't previously warned that that was going to happen, as I read from the script there. Marcus, our resident Finn, speaking for your entire population, of Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, which would you say is the least popular in Finland?
Oh gosh, I didn't expect for this. I think it's quite hard to find anyone in Finland who would say that he or she likes Donald Trump. I guess if you really, really search, you may find one or two Putin sympathizers. So I guess I would have to say that if we would have to choose between those two, I guess we would probably go east.
Really? That's interesting. Because there is a bit of history there between Finland and Russia.
There's a lot of history. There's still a bit difficult relationship between Russia and Finland. But then Donald Trump has been quite something exceptional, so to say. So,
exceptional is a carefully chosen word there, Marcus. Well done. But you, what do you think of Helsinki as a location?
I think it's a great location. I think it's interesting. Finland actually has a bit of history with organizing this kind of events. When you go through the Finnish schooling system, all the teachers are going on about the importance of 1970s and when Helsinki organized a summit, the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. That's the first time really when the nations from the East Bloc and the West got together. That was the first time when the leaders of East and West Germany, for example, met face to face. And that is something that actually was kind of the beginning of the change in that relationship. So that was a very historical meeting, and Finland has taken a lot of pride from that. That was also a recognition of Finland as a neutral ground. It didn't belong to the West that way. It didn't belong to the East either. So what Finland has actively been trying to do for decades is to be something a bit like Switzerland, a neutral ground that can benefit from that position in order to organize this kind of events, for example. And obviously, there are many pros for Helsinki or Finland as a location. I think one important point is that Finland hasn't really been involved in many conflicts in recent years, not at all. I think it's interesting. One example is that I have a friend who's working for the European Union office in Tel Aviv, Israel, for example, and she told me that there are quite a few Finns working there, which is great because Finns have had absolutely nothing to do with the Middle Eastern conflict. So you have neutral staff over there. And similarly, when you invite world leaders to Finland, they are in a neutral ground and it may be easier to talk about difficult things.
Tom Edwards, the Scandinavia in general's made something of a specialty of itself as a neutral location for peace talks. One thinks of the Oslo Accords, of course, Reagan and Gorbachev in Reykjavik in 1986. Is it, as Marcus says, because of their history that they are especially suitable for that sort of thing?
I think to a significant degree it is. I mean, it's questionable whether you could argue that Finland is a truly disinterested party in a meeting between the US and Russia, given 20th century history. And I think Marcus slightly glossed over some of those awkwardnesses with the Russians over the years. But I think it's true to a degree. What interests me is, and if we broaden this out to the whole of the Nordic region, Northern Europe, even bringing in Iceland as well, how often we see meetings that could potentially become rather overheated, and maybe the clue is in the word, taking place in these zones that are a little cooler. And I mean that in every sense of the word. And what's funny, Andrew, if you go back, particularly through the Cold War, it wasn't even just actual diplomacy, but the so-called, you know, ping-pong type diplomacy as well. Reykjavik was chosen as the location, famously, where Bobby Fischer took on Boris Spassky in chess. I think it was always viewed as a place where people could literally and metaphorically keep their cool. I don't know if that's how it's viewed in the region.
I have to say that I wasn't glossing anything over when I was talking about Finland, the relationship between Finland and Russia. That's been something that's been very much evolving over the years, and Finland actually is a country nowadays that says against Russia as well. I think one interesting point also is the Finnish nature and how it's different. Martti Ahtisaari, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, he used to organize crisis meetings between warring parties in the Finnish countryside. So, for example, he invited people from leaders and politicians and rebel leaders from Indonesia all the way to Finland, and he was hosting them in a cabin in the middle of a forest somewhere outside of Helsinki. And when you think of these people coming from, you know, coming from a hot country,
well, there's a febrile
when they atmosphere. Are brought over to Finland and they are sitting in a cabin next to a lake and they can go swimming and enjoy the nature and sit down in a sauna even, maybe that's something totally different. Maybe that actually forces you think outside of the box.
Or bore people into submission. Potentially, controversially.
Fernando, do you want to speak up here for we folk from more temperate climates of the Southern Hemisphere? I think Australia, or indeed Brazil, could put on a perfectly satisfactory peace summit.
I think as well. And it's funny because you mentioned Australia and Brazil. I think we're actually fairly neutral in the world stage as well. At least
about to say we were in fact at war and I'd missed something in the last 15 minutes.
At least I can say that for Brazil as well. I think we have a big role at the UN, you know, and international stage. I think we could compete with Scandinavia as well, but I do think Scandinavia is a good place to be. And I can imagine Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in a sauna session.
Fernando,
as well.
Less corruption in my part of the world. Sorry.
We have better beaches.
Tom, if we actually imagine this meeting, which I imagine is inevitable at some point, as long as Donald Trump's presidency lasts that long. Trump and Putin actually meeting. Is Donald Trump obliged to make some gesture of defiance? One imagines that the whole Manchurian candidate narrative plays pretty badly with him.
I just wonder how cerebral his approach to this will be. You know, he styled himself as a deal maker. He's failed to make deals, even domestically, with the deck stacked in his favour. I just think that Putin and his inner circle are far more practiced, they're far more accomplished in the true art of international diplomacy. He's also a career politician. You know, he has spent decades perfecting the way to meet with people, the way to maneuver, to manipulate a particular situation to his advantage. I just worry that, well, don't worry, I just suspect that Trump will be outmatched in any meeting. And he may try, you know, a few ruses. I just don't think he's got the subtlety, the political subtlety, or the substance to actually even seek to make such a conciliatory offer, far less actually deliver it.
What I was thinking over here is that also when you're organizing an event like that, a meeting like that, the setting is also important in terms of what you do when these parties are not meeting. What else is there to do? That's why these kind of meetings often take place in huge cities and exciting locations. And I guess Finland has something to offer as well. I make it sound really boring, my country, but I think sauna actually is a very important part of the culture. And there was one previous president in Finland who used to do diplomacy in sauna. So he would invite world leaders over and then he would take them to sauna. And there you would be, sweating a bit red, naked. And then you would talk about important things. And I guess, once again, when you're in a place like that, it makes you maybe a bit more diplomatic.
Well, on that happy visual image, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Marcus Hippie, Tom Edwards and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up next, overwrought drama from Brazil, and we'll also be talking about telenovelas.
On Meet the Writers this week, join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to multi-award-winning Irish author John Boyne. His work, Boy in the Striped Pajamas, sold more than 9 million copies worldwide, It was a New York Times number one bestseller. It's now a film and a play. Boyne's new book, The Heart's Invisible Furies, examines issues close to his life. That's John Boyne on Meet the Writers, premiering this Saturday at 1500 London time, and thereafter available as a podcast.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still here are Marcus Hippie, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Edwards. And let's look now at Brazil, where the former Speaker of the Chamber of Deputies, Eduardo Cunha, is looking at 15 years and change of the Brazilian equivalent of porridge after being the latest Brazilian politician to be convicted of tax evasion, corruption and sundry skullduggery. It is quite a plummet by the Speaker, who last year was the prime orchestrator of the impeachment and defenestration of President Dilma Rousseff. Fernando, first of all, what is the Brazilian equivalent of porridge? I should have asked when I was writing the script.
Well, it's something called tapioca, you know, but...
That's what I should have said.
Exactly.
It's like said. 15 years of
white flour, I'm not a fan.
15 years and change of tapioca, that sounds even worse, doesn't it? Fernando, on the one hand, this does seem like an absolutely massive story, hugely important, influential politician sent down for 15 years. But speaking as a Brazilian, and I guess from what you've known from talking to people in Brazil and reading the Brazilian papers, does it seem a big deal, or is everyone at this point somewhat scandal weary? Because this has been dragging on for ages. This has already brought down at least one president, with one more to come. There are any number of senators and governors on the hook on various charges. Can anyone still get excited about this?
Officially, it's big news. You know, it's the main story on the papers. But I have to be honest, I think the average Brazilian is not shocked about it, you know, especially because we had more recent scandals about our meat industry, which had, you know, severe problems as well. But it is big news because finally he's being sentenced by this judge, Sergio Moro. He's the Operation Car Wash judge. And, you know, 15 years is quite a long time to be in prison as well. And I have to say, he's already in prison since October from last year, because the police arrested him. And people say, you know, it's better if he kept in jail, otherwise, you know, he's in danger or still doing corruption as he did, you know. And but if funny, he is the easiest one of them, because, you know, there were so many proofs against him.
He's also,
that it's almost funny, you know, because why it took so long for him to be sentenced.
But he's also a very unpopular man, isn't he?
It's interesting because he's very unpopular, but a very clever man as well. You know, he orchestrated Dilma Rousseff's impeachment, as you rightly said. You know, he had a lobby at the Congress. He was very extremely powerful. You know, and I say he's unpopular, but I think in his constituency, I don't think he was that unpopular in a way. He also belongs to the evangelical church. You know, so, you know, most Brazilians now hate him, but I think at the time where he was very powerful, he was not, you know, hated as much as we're saying here.
I did want to talk a bit as well about the role of the Speaker, which on the one hand does seem a somewhat arcane one, but most parliaments have one. It's clearly important. Tom, do you have a favourite Speaker in history?
Well, I don't know. It's interesting in this country. I mean, we have, I guess, the Speaker of the House of Commons is the equivalent here, and that's John Bercow, who himself is rather a divisive character, I think it's safe to say. Many people in recent vintage would cite someone like Betty Boothroyd, who is a very sort of familiar and friendly, sort of affable figure. I think the Speaker often has a key role to play. What strikes me as interesting about this particular case is this notion of, you know, the biter bit, or in Eduardo Cunha's face, a poacher turned gamekeeper, I guess turned game in the end.
Yeah, that's a better word. Gamekeeper turned game.
Yeah,
exactly.
And there is that worry that, you know, it's the lady doth protest too much. You know, the person who's first to make the accusations, it seems in recent Brazilian political history, is potentially the person with the most to hide. Now, I wonder whether, regardless of what people feel about Cunha, you know, is there a feeling, to complement that sense of ennui at corruption broadly, that there's just not any personnel left? You know, how many politicians are there who have a clean record? I mean, Fernando, I don't know, you know, when the next, you know, regional or big elections are, but it's almost like no one will be able to field candidates who are truly whiter than white.
Where are you on the rung on the ladder personally, Fernando? I mean, how many people end up in jail before you're president by default?
Well, it's an extremely difficult situation. You know what? I'm kind of scared, Andrew. I think Brazilians, you know, they were protesting, they were going to the streets in the last years, but I think now Brazilians are tired of protesting because no matter how much they go to protest, there's still so much corruption. So I have a terrible feeling about next year's election, actually.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we will move from one sort of Brazilian soap opera to another, specifically Brazil's famously overacted, underwritten telenovelas. A trend is apparently afoot of transforming these serials into musicals, a prospect about which I'm sure everyone is as excited as I am. Fernando, why is this happening? Why?
I have to say, I'm fairly excited about this, and I think, and my only question about this, why it took them so long? Because Brazilians love soap operas. I mean, it's easy money. Just make the soap opera into the theater. And what I find it amazing is that before, Brazilian theaters were full of like beauty, the Brazilian Beauty and the Beast, the Brazilian Phantom of the Opera. Now we're gonna have, you know, the Brazilian Vamp, your Rock Santeiro, this iconic Brazilian soap operas. I think this is very good news.
Well, to give us some perspective and to inform both us and I'm sure our agog listeners, we have a clip from one such. This is Vamp. Introduce it if you would, Fernando.
Well, I think we should hear a clip and then I'll tell you a bit more about it. You love
or
it.
Or we could do it that way around. That's fine. Now, that is not an original composition, Fernando. That is just about dimly recognizable as the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. Who is caterwauling that?
I have to explain. This is the character Natasha, the main character of the soap. She's basically a rock star. But the only reason she became a rock star because she sold her soul to the devil because she wanted to be famous.
So it's Faust, basically.
Exactly. But so, and then she became famous. She was touring all over Europe. But then, you know, she became a vampire, so she can't see the sunlight.
Can I just quickly interrupt because I have to say something really important? I've got a massive issue. I think this is a very bad development. I've got a massive issue with the whole concept of musicals. I think musicals have been designed for people who don't really have taste in music because they try to appeal to so many people that the songs normally end up being quite average. And I just don't get it. I've been trying to watch musicals. I'm normally quite bored. The plot's not going anywhere. And when it's finally going somewhere, everyone bursts into an average song that lasts
for about three or four minutes.
Marcus, you've never seen a Brazilian musical, that's why. And I have to say, the Vampy, you know, they're doing a musical 25 years after the soap was aired. And you know who's going to be Natasha again?
Do tell me. The same actress.
Claude Johanna.
I wonder if this works in different cultures. Tom Edwards, I know you love EastEnders, Coronation Street, Emmerdale, all those. What if they started making musical episodes?
I would not necessarily be a fan. I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with this area. I probably broadly like Marcus. However, I don't mind a musical if it is focused on something where music is at its core. By which I mean, for example, say The Commitments, the sort of musical version of Roddy Doyle's book.
We Will Rock You, which I believe you've seen 27 times.
No, but this is a great sort because it's about a band. Or even...
I know, that's made... Yeah.
But also the songs in The Commitments, if I remember rightly, weren't actually written for the thing. They were...
No, this is a bit of a cheat. They're
songs. Amazing
soul standards. But then with some original piece, maybe something like Cabaret, whereby, you know, it's... action is set in a smoke-filled music hall. You know, we're in Berlin. It's a period piece. It works because it's the driver of the story. Where, as Marcus points out, in a general...
I fell asleep when I was watching
Moulin
Rouge.
...scenario, people just break into song. I can't get on board
with
Tony,
it.
I'm sorry,
case,
Fernando.
No, in that case, it's a very good excuse. She wants to be a rock star. Sold her soul to the devil. Here you go. A rock star is what they do. They
and also,
sing.
If it's the Rolling Stones, I mean, yeah. Well, I was going to say, how bad could it be? We did hear.
She has a very nice vampire sexy outfit as well, so...
Yeah. Marcus, are there any Finnish soap operas that would translate well to the musical stage?
There's Salatut Elämät, which is in English it translates as Hidden Secret Lives, and it's about this one building block where, well, undescribable things happen in most of flat, it seems, when I've been watching that program. I guess that would work quite well because Well, I guess because those people who watched that series, maybe they lack the taste I was talking about earlier.
and or an attempt to turn that into a musical could become the basis for a Finnish rewrite of The Producers. On that cinematic note, Tom Edwards, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Marcos Hippie, thank you all very much for joining us. That is all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Anthony Olongo. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900. Marcus is back with The Menu, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.